the war?
Tuesday, September the 12th, a full to bursting day at the White House, began for me with one of those sweet, happy things you love to remember. Hugh O'Brien, our friend of many entertainments, had been through the house the day before with his four aunts. I'd heard about it and asked them to come back for coffee with me this morning and a special upstairs tour. At 11 o'clock, Bess had them out on the Truman balcony, a sparkling, golden autumn day, the kind when merely to be alive is enough. And there they were, all talking at once, two of them, about the trip they were taking to Europe on the last sailing of the big ocean liner, the Queen Mary, I believe it is. Hugh was treating them to it, and that was what was so dear and sweet to me. And the other two old aunts had come to Washington, and he was entertaining all four of them here. He was lean and handsome and joking, and they rattled on about what he did when he was a little boy, how thrilled they were to be in the White House. And then Lyndon came out. I love him for doing things like this. He always joins me when I have guests, if he can. What delighted me was the sheer, simple kindness of Hugh's caring that these old ladies had an exciting time, and believe me, they were going to. Hugh asked us if we'd like to see a magic trick. Oh, we would. So he got out some bright-colored silk handkerchiefs and pulled them out of unexpected places, like an empty hand, or my hand, all bedazzling and completely non-understandable to me, while his aunts chattered on about how he had partly worked his way through school with his magic, and even began as a little boy charging the kids to watch him. A little before 12, I went in for an appointment with Bill Hardiman, the president of the National Association of Travel Organizations, a Georgia tourist man whom I wanted to hear discuss their opinion on the highway beautification bill. Sharon and Liz were with me. Sharon, very well organized, her opinions documented, quiet and persuasive, a most intelligent young woman. Georgia apparently has made considerable strides in beautifying its own highways with planting out of trees by 4-H and other youth organizations, especially dogwoods, and by visitor centers at the state line. But I felt quite sure when we ended that Mr. Hardiman and his organization had sizable reservations about the Highway Beautification Act, because it might take down some billboards advertising their motels and attractions, as he put the word. Also, I felt sure he didn't know much what it was about. He was startled that of the $85 million small sum that's left by the Senate bill, $70 million would be for highway planting, $10 million for junkyard screening or removal, and only $5 million for payment for taking down some billboards. Next, I worked with Ashton, had lunch on a tray, recorded some, and then at 3:30, went to the South Grounds for the most unique party that's ever been held here in my time, or in all the times I've read about. A country fair for the children of congressmen and cabinet members and government officials and White House staff between the ages of 6 and 18. There was a Ferris wheel and a merry-go-round, and a pony ring around the fountain, and red striped tents that had hot dogs and Coca-Cola and taffy apples, popcorn and cotton candy. The view from the top of the Ferris wheel of the White House ground, dotted with red striped tents, about 500 children, milling, running, laughing, was one I'll never forget. Linda Bird was there nearly the whole time, dressed in a delightful costume of sort of camel-colored culottes with a western cowboy hat. In part, this had all begun in my mind because I remembered what Linda and Lucy used to say when they were little and we'd start out for dinner and they didn't want us to go. "Why are you always going out, Mama?" And then once Linda said, "Mama, Washington is sure meant for the congressmen and their wives, but it's not meant for their children." I wore a navy blue dress with a red and white scarf, and all of the many hostesses were in red, white, and blue, the men wearing red striped Barker's vests and little straw hats. Tyler Abel, handsome and laughing, was running the Ferris wheel. Everybody had been roped in on a job. Jane Freeman was a fortune teller, and so was Scooter Miller, dressed up in about 30 strands of beads, a sequin blouse, her pepper and salt hair augmented by a gray wig. But the most fun to me were the antique cars. There were about 10 of them lined up in the White House drive with their owners, who were the chauffeurs. It was a 1909 Mitchell and a 1915 Ford. And the youngest of the lot was a 1932 Ford with a rumble seat. And I'm sure I must have dated in its contemporary at the University of Texas 35 years ago. and thought it very snazzy. I sent to the archives to get my pink picture hat from Woodstock, Vermont brought out and took a spin around at least three times. The brass on the cars were gleaming, but not as bright as their owner's smiles. Hubert came out, said he had one just like the 1951 at home in Waverly, and offered to give me a ride. The owner trustingly assented, and off we put chug, chug, chug. Lyndon came out with Yuki and immediately became a sort of a Pied Piper, with the children following in behind him, wanting autographs and taking pictures. And to my dismay, he picked up Yuki, and they put on their act where Yuki talks to him. I could have done without that. Yuki ended with kissing his cheek. I think everybody was having a good time, unless maybe it was poor Chuck, whom the newspaper women were in behind in such droves that Liz got him to be my escort, and he was everywhere at my elbow. I was mad about the sack races. Hello? A lot of determined children, mostly between about 6 and 14, climbed into sacks which they clutched around their waist. At the signal, set off in a race for the finish line about a half a block away down the White House lawn. There were many tumbles on the grassy slopes and prizes, and there was one determined little girl with blonde curls and red and white checkered dress who went in every race, time after time, no matter what age the children, and won a lot of them. All in all, it was an hilarious afternoon. I gave up completely on discipline and had something of everything. Popcorn, of course, and a soft drink. And at great peril to my teeth, a taffy apple. And last, I went whole hog with a hot dog. It was a putting contest on Eisenhower's Green, and there so close to the trees on the west side was the familiar black and white linoleum dance floor, happily used in summers past, but not this rainy summer. But this afternoon, the youngsters from 14 to 18 were giving it a good workout with a fast, hot little band. Well, it was the most fun, and I took my hat off to Bess and all her planning, and to all the wonderful hostesses who had helped out, and to the generous people from the amusement parks and the candy companies and the toy manufacturers who had so generously helped on it. I was surprised when I asked the time, and it was 5:30, and I didn't think it'd been over 30 minutes, and I didn't want to go in even then. In fact, the crowd was scarcely diminishing at all, but I went upstairs, and they began to gradually trail out to anxious mothers waiting in cars at the gates. What a day for traffic this must have been outside. Jean-Louis came and gave me a comb-out, a fancy one, in fact. Fall is here, and it is time to go to work. This is a third of our series of small upstairs parties. Dinner at round tables in the family dining room, and drinks on the Truman balcony of the yellow room. Hubert was here without Muriel, and Dean came late. He'd been to meet the Japanese ministers at the airport, and Virginia was out of town. And the young, attractive Trowbridges were a very charming part of the evening. I was in the yellow room by 8, in a gold lamé dress, one of my Eastern fabrics that Adele Simpson had made up for me, covering it with chiffon. We'd asked quite a few senators, the John McClellans. Norma is always lovely and so very feminine. And tall, handsome, my always favorite, George Smathers, with my sometime bridge partner, Rosemary, and Betty Talmadge, with Herman. I dare say one of the first times this year he stayed up past 8 o'clock. These four are among my southern favorites, and in widely diverse parts of our country, two other favorites, the Gale McGees. I find both of them charming and highly intelligent, and the young Walter Mondales of Minnesota. The first arrival was Cyril Magnin, Linda's friend, and the other single guest was Brooke Astor, just out of the hospital, a little less ebullient than I always remember her. She gravitated right away to the Averill Harrimans, and she and Marie, it turned out, had known each other all of their lives, and there were some delightful sketches of reminiscences. From Brooke about her first marriage, she was 16. Across Lafayette Park at St. John's Church, she recommended it for Linda. And from Marie, that they were about to celebrate their, I think it was 34th our fifth wedding anniversary. We were on the subject of Linda's wedding, and a delightful statement from her that went something like this. My dear, marriage in any case is wonderful. The longer I know Averill, the better I like him. It is more than that. It's an enormous respect and admiration for someone who's willing to work for his government in any capacity, so long at such tough jobs, with an apparent shrugging off of title, our need of recognition. One of the most interesting couples were the young William Hewitts, Republicans for Johnson in 64. He's chairman of the John Deere Company. Both of them are over 6 feet tall, I think. His wife, a very striking woman, red-haired, a good horsewoman. She just returned from Japan and was full of her trip and her admiration for the people. And the Leonard McCollums were a comfortable addition. Talking of George and Alice Brown and their hunting trips together, they just finished one. George has lost the sight of one eye, practically. But, Leonard says, he's adjusted his arm and his holding of the gun so that he can shoot pretty well with the other eye and enjoys the company and the trip just as much as ever. They're gallant folks, the Browns. From the house, there were the John Blatniks of Minnesota. I had not known them well, though he is one of the chief champions for a highway beautification bill. They were a very attractive couple. He's tall and white-haired and very solid-looking, almost formidable, but also pleasant. And the young Ed Edmondson, her leg in a cast from a simple household accident, and she'd flown all the way up from Oklahoma, where she's keeping the children in school for the fall, just to come to this party. I was flattered. At dinner, I had George Smathers on my right and Frank Church on my left. All the talk of his being recalled has abated and may even help his chances in the election. But he looks upon it as a rough one, and they're both campaigning hard. I liked his description, and I think it's right, of Bethine. He said she can walk right through a picnic or a country fair and out the other side, and she'll have more friends than I could have made if I'd stayed there 2 hours. The population explosion and birth control were most of his conversation for the evening, and I repeated what I've often thought, that if I was destined to be born into politics, I was mighty glad I wasn't born in India, that the problems you faced would be so nearly insoluble that it would be total frustration. And what are the problems of the next generation, or somewhere down the line, of American politicians, of politicians anywhere? Suppose we learn how to control the weather. And think a minute of the economic, legal, and spiritual fallout of all the population control measures. How is somebody going to cope with them 50 or 100 years down the road? So I guess we ought to relax with today's problems. Frank was firmly of the opinion that sometime there would have to be enforced population control. With George, it was a much lower key, warm and easy conversation. Reminiscences about Bibi and our younger days, and my own keenly expressed regret that he, or so it's said, is getting out of politics when he finishes this term. He wisely did not affirm or deny, but the tone said that he is. You know, if you're ever going to make a change, there just comes a time in life when you have to do it, or else you're hooked for the rest of your years. The ladies had coffee in the yellow room while I showed a few of them who were not familiar with the White House, Mrs. Hewitt and Mrs. McCollum, the Queen's room. And Mrs. McCollum recognized Ovita's chandelier. The gentlemen joined us rather early. It was a pleasant, successful, bright evening, I thought. At least I passed the test of the hostess having a good time, and it was close to 11:30, and no surprise to me, Herman Talmadge made the move to go, and then quickly they slipped away, the most hard-working ones of them first. Secretary Rusk, himself the most courteous of men, somehow manages to drift away like fog, unnoticed. At an early hour, Linda Bird had come in, brought Chuck around, introduced him to everybody, the pleasant little ripple of excitement and approval following them as they walked around the room. It was 11:30 when Lyndon took the guests down to the South Lawn to say goodbye, and I went to bed with my reading and that satisfied feeling of a well-done party.